The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be presenting the latest vision news. Today's vision news is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. First up, from fightingblindness.org, IRD community loses Usher syndrome research trailblazer William Kimberling, Ph.D. The Foundation Fighting Blindness is saddened to report the passing of William J. Kimberling, Ph.D., a pioneer in Usher syndrome research and a member of the Foundation's Scientific Advisory Board from 1999 to 2015. Dr. Kimberling received his Ph.D. in medical genetics from Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Kimberling worked at the Boys Town National Research Hospital in Omaha, Nebraska, for over 40 years, where he served as director of the Center for the Study and Treatment of Usher Syndrome and director of the Gene Markers Laboratory. The creation of the William Kimberling Usher Research Laboratory was dedicated in 2015 to honor his hard work and commitment to families affected by Usher syndrome. Dr. Kimberling was our go-to Usher syndrome researcher and advocate for patients and families, said Amy Laster, Senior Vice President, Science Strategy and Awards, Foundation Fighting Blindness. From Capitol Hill to research seminars to visions conferences, he passionately educated the world about Usher syndrome and the need for research to overcome it. His commitment to the Usher syndrome community was heroic. Dr. Kimberling published more than 250 scholarly papers on a variety of topics, from population cytogenetics to kidney disease. He focused his studies on the genetics of sensory loss, specifically on combined vision and hearing loss, and his laboratory was responsible for the identification and characterization of several genes that cause Usher syndrome. He received more than $1.5 million in awards from the Foundation Fighting Blindness and an additional $20,000 awarded to the Boys Town National Research Hospital during his tenure. The Foundation is extremely grateful for Dr. Kimberling's distinguished career and dedication to the Usher syndrome community. Also from fightingblindness.org, Charlie Kramer, life coach for the disabled. 29-year-old Charlie Kramer is well known as a life coach, public speaker, and for his work as an advocate for the disabled community on social media. But until a few years ago, Charlie didn't want to openly share his journey with vision loss. Charlie was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, RP, at just 5 years old. At first, Charlie didn't notice he was seeing any differently than his friends until around middle school. As Charlie's sight continued to deteriorate, at 16 years old, he went through mobility training and received a white cane. But he only used it if he was in a public place with large crowds, like Disney or a concert. He would bump into his classmates walking through the hallways at school, but he never thought or wanted to use a white cane. Charlie's mom, Colette, also has RP and has been involved with the Los Angeles Foundation Fighting Blindness chapter for over 30 years. Colette volunteered the Kramer family to become the first family chair for the Los Angeles Vision Walk about 16 years ago, and the whole family has participated every year since. It's important to our family to be present and advocate for those in our community, says Charlie. The Foundation and Vision Walk are so important in our lives. It's always been helpful for me to be exposed to others with vision loss, even if I haven't always been open about it myself. Charlie's true passion in life has always been helping and empowering others. In the last few years, Charlie has developed programs to help people work through their own personal journey with their disability. Now, Charlie's a full-time life coach for those with disabilities, and he also works with businesses, schools, and organizations to help them learn how best to include people with disabilities. My career taking off has really given me the ability to look at my vision loss as a tool to help people, says Charlie. When I was younger, I wasn't accepting of who I was, and I was pushing my RP to the side. But in 2019, it was almost like coming out of the closet for me. It transformed my life, career, and impact on the world, and now I feel more comfortable in my own skin. In addition to helping others, Charlie also has a passion for sharing his story through music. In January 2019, Charlie created a musical experience called Singing in the Dark, performing at conferences and synagogues across the country. "I think everyone can be blind to something," says Charlie. "Singing in the Dark is an opportunity to not only raise awareness for the visually impaired community, but for people to open up and accept what they might be blind to in their lives, whether it's physical, mental, or spiritual." In 2021, Charlie released his first album, called Blind, featuring songs he's written sharing his diagnosis and personal struggles with RP. "For so long, I was hesitant to do what I really wanted because I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to achieve it while having RP," says Charlie. "But I work my butt off and live my dream every day. I may have to do things a little differently, but I can still do anything, and so can anyone." To learn more about Charlie, visit www.charliekramervision.com. From usnews.com, stem cell therapy could be breakthrough against type 1 diabetes, by Denise Mann, Health Day reporter. Dateline October 4th. People with type 1 diabetes lack functional islet cells in their pancreas to produce the hormone insulin and must take daily insulin via injections or a continuous pump to compensate. But if new research pans out, some folks with type 1 diabetes may no longer need to take insulin. The study of 6 people with type 1 diabetes found that an investigational off-the-shelf form of islet stem cell therapy improves blood sugar control and slashes insulin needs, with 3 people no longer needing any daily insulin. Given via an infusion, VX880 are stem cell-derived insulin-producing islet cells that essentially replace the dysfunctional islet cells in people with type 1 diabetes. The study was funded by VX880 maker Vertex, V-E-R-T-X, Pharmaceuticals. Islet cells have the potential to cure diabetes, and I believe this study is a huge step forward in that direction, said study author Dr. Trevor Reichman, R-E-I-C-H-M-A-N, surgical director of the Pancreas and Islet Transplant Program at University Health Network's AJMERA, A-J-M-E-R-A, Transplant Center in Toronto, Canada. Type 1 diabetes occurs when the pancreas produces little to no insulin. Insulin is needed to help blood sugar or glucose enter the cells, where it is used for energy. When insulin is in short supply, glucose can build up, causing such symptoms as extreme fatigue, blurry vision, weight loss, and confusion. Stem cells can multiply exponentially and morph into disparate types of cells. The cells used in VX880 are grown in a lab. Once implanted, they morph into islet cells and can produce insulin. They are essentially off the shelf, but do take several weeks to produce prior to infusion, Reichman said. In the new study, all 6 people treated with VX880 had improved glycemic control, as shown by elimination of severe low blood sugar reactions, improved HbA1c, a snapshot of blood sugar levels over time, and the amount of time their blood sugar levels were in the recommended range within 3 months. As a result, these patients needed less insulin or none at all. "The impact was truly life-changing," Reichman said. "All of these patients had long-standing, difficult-to-manage type 1 diabetes with life-threatening complications, which included severe hypoglycemic unawareness. Hypoglycemia unawareness means a person can't tell when their blood glucose gets low, so they don't know they need to treat it. Within 3 months, this was eliminated in all study participants." Exactly how long these effects will last is not yet known. The longest patients in follow-up is now at 2 years and maintains insulin independence, Reichman said. The research is ongoing. The study showed that VX880 is safe and no serious side effects were reported. People do need to take immunosuppressant drugs to prevent rejection, which Reichman called a potential roadblock for broader use. The future goal is to create a version of the treatment that does not require immunosuppressive therapy, he said. The study is limited to people aged 18 through 65 years of age, but in the future, kids may be included. The findings were presented Tuesday at a meeting of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes in Hamburg, Germany. Findings presented at medical meetings should be considered preliminary until they are published in a peer-reviewed journal. Dr. John Buse, BUSC, is the director of Diabetes Care Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. The important thing here is that people do not need organ donors to have a source of insulin-producing cells for transplant, said Buse, who reviewed the findings. The new stem cell treatment seems to work pretty well, he added. The patients have to take immunosuppression, but they had severe hypoglycemia beforehand, so that is a reasonable trade-off for having to take insulin, Buse said. Health Day has more on type 1 diabetes at the Hot Link. Sources, Trevor Reichman, MD, Surgical Director, Pancreas and Islet Transplant Program, University Health Network's Ajmera Transplant Center, Toronto, Ontario, Canada. John Buse, MD, PhD, Director, University of North Carolina Diabetes Care Center, Chapel Hill, NC. Presentation, European Association for the Study of Diabetes, Meeting, Hamburg, Germany, October 3rd, 2023. Copyright 2023 by Health Day. All rights reserved. From USAtoday.com, a high-voltage wire destroyed his face. Doctors just gave him a new one. Aaron James was working as a high-voltage lineman in June 2021 when his face touched a live wire. 7,200 volts of electricity coursed through his body, costing him his left eye and much of the arm that reached up to try to protect it. It also burned his nose, lips, cheek, and chin down to the bone. Badly disfigured, the military veteran from Hot Springs, Arkansas, couldn't taste, smell, or eat solid foods. In May, James, now 46, underwent surgery at NYU Langone Health to replace the tissue on his face and give him a new left eye. The Langone Health is L-A-N-G-O-N-E. More than 45 people have received a face transplant worldwide since 2021, but James is the first to receive an eye along with a new face. It's not yet clear whether the new eye, which comes from the same donor as the rest of the face, will ever allow him to see, but it appears to be healthy so far. The team hoped that the transplant would provide a cosmetic improvement and that the eye might work. On Thursday, James and his doctors shared his story publicly for the first time. They talked about his injury, his donor, and the efforts to give him back a normal life. James said the surgery helped restore his self-confidence. Since the transplant, I tell people I can't walk past a mirror without looking at it, James told reporters. It has made me stand up taller. 5 months after the surgery, James is healing well, said Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez, director of the face transplant program and chair of the Hans-Jürg Wyss, that's W-Y-S-S, Department of Plastic Surgery at NYU Langone, who led the process. He can't see out of the transplanted eye yet, and may never, but he can eat, smell, and taste again, speak more normally, and is no longer hooked up to tubes or machines. The surgery began May 27th at 9:14 a.m. and finished 21 hours later at 7:51 a.m. on May 28th, over Memorial Day weekend. It included a 14-person medical team working across two operating rooms and followed 15 full-scale rehearsals over 3 months, including 3D-printed replicas of James's anatomy to help the team understand what they needed to do. Rodriguez credited the team's success to their months of planning and dedication, and to James's personality and his family's unwavering support. Aaron is not a guy you're going to keep down. He's a fighter, Rodriguez said. Serious risks involved. Rodriguez, who performed his first face transplant in 2012, said he chooses candidates carefully because of the riskiness of the procedure and the extreme emotional toll of this type of injury and surgical recovery. He can't promise them they will survive the surgery or how long they will live after. I tell these patients, you basically will have 10 years. Is it worth the risk? Rodriguez said, explaining that transplant medications are known to cause life-limiting organ damage. That first patient from 2012 is still doing well, though, he said. So we don't know exact timeline or longevity of face transplants. Eye transplants had been considered too risky because of the medications, the chance a transplant could cause a brain infection, and the low expectation of success. But James would need the medication to protect his new face even if the new eye didn't work. So there was little added risk of including the eye, Rodriguez said. At first, the expectation was just that the donor eye would help restore James to a more typical appearance. But as doctors began considering his case, they wondered if they might be able to get it to work again, too, Rodriguez said. Historically, eyes have been considered too challenging to transplant because of the risks of immune rejection and the need for the newly implanted eye to regenerate nerves and blood flow to the retina. The results so far have exceeded their expectations and are incredibly surprising, he said. We've got an eye that's alive and an eye connected to the optic nerve, which is a direct connection to the brain. Although James's initial care following the injury was in Texas, the NYU team was involved early enough that when his eye was removed, they recommended cutting the optic nerve as close to the eyeball as possible to preserve nerve length and maximize options for later reconstruction. Nerves grow slowly, so it is still conceivable that the optic nerve in the new eye could connect to James's brain and begin sending signals. Doctors admitted the surgery is so novel that they don't know when or whether that will happen. Blood is flowing to the new retina, the area at the back of the eye that receives light and sends images to the brain, a sign the eye is healthy. Dr. Vaidehi Dedania, that's Vaidehi Dedania, the ophthalmologist who later led that part of the procedure, said at the news conference. The cornea is also connected and looks normal, she said. Going into this case, I was hopeful the eye would survive 90 days at the very most. Dr. Bruce Gelb, G-E-L-B, a transplant surgeon at the NYU Langone Transplant Institute and vice chair of quality in surgery, said in a statement, but the fact that at 5 months out we have a viable cornea paired with a retina showing great blood flow, I think we've already hit a home run. Anything above that is exceptional, and any additional recovery from the eye will be unexpected and exciting to see, he said. It's like us witnessing a supernova. We will continue to monitor and learn more over time. James is blue-eyed, while the donor eye is brown. He can't yet control the eyelid over the new eye, though he has recently begun to be able to squint, which other face transplant recipients have not been able to do. He said the eye color difference doesn't bother him at all. It could be pink and I wouldn't care. Even if he is never able to see out of that eye, Rodriguez said the success so far is a total game changer. Previously, doctors have been able to reconnect nerves in the so-called peripheral nervous system, which includes the limbs and face, but not in the central nervous system, which is why spinal cord injuries have been considered irreversible. The success with James changes that assumption, Rodriguez said. We've crossed into the frontier of the central nervous system, he said. I think the options are limitless, depending on the generosity of another. The donor was a man in his 30s who came from a family that strongly supports organ donation, said Leonard Achan, A-C-H-A-N, president and CEO of Live On New York, which led the effort to find a donor for James. The man, whose cause of death and name have not been identified, also donated his kidneys, liver, and pancreas, saving three other people between the ages of 20 and 70, Achan said in a statement. In addition to the whole left eye and eye socket, James received from the donor the tissue that covered his nose, left upper and lower eyelids, left eyebrow, upper and lower lips, skull, cheek, nasal, and chin bone segments, and tissues below the right eye, including the underlying muscles, blood vessels, and nerves. The beard James sports comes from the donor, too. He also received cells from the donor's bone marrow, withdrawn from the man's pelvis, that doctors hope will help James's optic nerve to repair and connect to the donor eye. The deceased man's face was replaced with a 3D-printed replica after the transplant. Rodriguez said this enabled the donor's family to follow their traditional burial rituals. James has not met the donor family, but hopes to someday. Rodriguez, who has met the family, described them as incredibly kind and generous, and he noted that they didn't hesitate at all to help out Aaron and other patients whose lives they changed. Moving on with life. James, an Army veteran who served three tours of duty in the Middle East, said he has no memory of the accident that nearly cost him his life, or of that day at all. Everything has been different since. The experience sucked, but it made him incredibly grateful for his family and friends who have stood by him. When he offered to let his wife Megan out of their 20-year marriage, she wouldn't hear of it. She said, "No, we're in this to the end." James said he's now focused on his recovery and not thinking too far ahead. "You get through one day and thank God for the next. It's all you can do right now," he said. "I think I'm done worrying about too far in the future. We're not going for the piece of paper saying, you're going to live to be 80 years old." Rodriguez admitted he was anxious the day he unveiled James's new face to him for the first time, but thrilled by his reaction. "It was very difficult to have a dry eye in that room." The surgeon praised James and his family for their energy and dedication to his recovery. "As long as he takes care of that face, I think he will have a great life moving forward," Rodriguez said. Contact Karen Weintraub, Weintraub, at kweintraub@usatoday.com. Health and patient safety coverage at USA Today is made possible in part by a grant from the Masimo Foundation for Ethics, Innovation, and Competition in Healthcare. The Masimo Foundation does not provide editorial input. From AARP the magazine, November-December 2023, Driving in the Dark. When aging eyes meet nighttime roadways, driving can be hazardous. Here's why we struggle to see in the dark and how you can make the road you travel safer. Article by Tom Vanderbilt, photographs by Kevin Cooley. My wife was recently on the phone trying to arrange a dinner rendezvous for that evening with her parents, both in their 80s. "How about 7, she asked, offering a time she thought was reasonable. "Maybe 6 is better," her mother countered. "Let's say 5, her father weighed in. Suddenly, we were scrambling to get ready, wondering why we needed to rush. Turns out he wasn't trying to catch some early bird special. The simple reason was he doesn't like driving at night. He's hardly alone. Older drivers, in 2020 there were some 48 million licensed drivers over 65 in the U.S., tend to self-regulate, studies show, and they take themselves out of driving in riskier situations. The most common safety choice older drivers make is not to drive after dark. With good reason. Half of all fatal car crashes happen after dark, according to data from the National Safety Council, even though only 25% of driving happens then. At night, drivers are less likely to wear seatbelts, more often under the influence of alcohol, more prone to be fatigued. But there's another problem: vision. How we see in the dark. Humans are born with two types of photoreceptors in their eyes, rods and cones. In the daytime, we utilize cones, the structures that allow us to see color. With the onset of night, we shift to a mix of rods and cones. In very, very low light, we rely entirely on rods, which is why in the darkness, everything appears black and white. When you age, you lose rods before you lose cones, says Cynthia Owsley, O-W-S-L-E-Y, the chair of ophthalmology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So while our vision in daylight may be just fine, our night vision becomes less acute. In people with age-related medical conditions that affect sight, this process is even more pronounced, she notes. At the same time, our pupils, which regulate how much light enters our eyes, shrink with age, says John Bullough, B-U-L-L-O-U-G-H, program director at the Light and Health Research Center at Mount Sinai Hospital's ICHN, I-C-H-N, School of Medicine in New York City. The older we are, the smaller our pupils are, he says. Even for the same light level, there's less light getting inside our eyeball. By the time we hit our 60s, he adds, the backs of our eyes are receiving only one-third the light they did when we were 20. The world just gets darker day by day, he says. The only reason we don't notice is because it's so gradual. As we age, we also become less sensitive to changes in contrast, and thus less able to distinguish objects, like road signs or pedestrians, from their background. And the darker it gets, the more challenged our sight becomes, especially when it's a question of spotting objects along the side of the road. A study by the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute found that pedestrian fatalities were 22% more likely to occur on nights when there was a new and essentially invisible moon than on brighter nights with a full moon. Plus, in low contrast conditions, it's difficult to estimate how fast objects, such as other cars, are moving, and our reaction times are slowed. What's more, by the time we reach our late 50s, nearly 1 in 10 of us will suffer from cataracts, a blurring caused by a buildup of protein in the disc-like lenses behind our pupils. By the time we hit our 80s, more than half of us will have cataracts. Everyone who lives long enough, whether their eyes are healthy or not, will experience cataracts, Pelos says. How to lighten up. The good news is that headlights are, in some cases, getting better at lighting the roadway ahead of us. A testing initiative by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, IIHS, found that vehicles equipped with top-rated headlights have 19% fewer nighttime crashes than do cars with lower-rated lights. As opposed to older headlights, which use a halogen bulb backed by a reflective surface, the best new headlights use LED bulbs with a so-called projector lens, explains Matt Brumbelow, a senior research engineer with the IIHS. Now you can have a much better beam pattern that gets enough light onto the road, he says. But even pricey LED lights don't always ensure good illumination. You might have a really expensive headlight system that doesn't do well, Brumbelow says. There are lots of LED bulbs not designed to light up the road. They may be there to make a style statement about a car brand. If you're considering a new car, and if driving at night is a concern, check out IIHS.org, which offers overall safety ratings on vehicles, including for headlights. Still, having the best headlights is only half the battle. You also need to use them well, especially your high beams. In fact, most of us use our high beams a lot less than we could. Curiously, Bullo points out, low beam headlights initially weren't ever really designed to be the main headlights for us to be driving with. They were called the passing beams, he said. And then you had the driving beams, which were your high beam headlights. Over time, owing perhaps to busier roadways and more streetlights, we've defaulted to using our passing beams for much of our driving. Even on dark rural roads without much traffic, some three-quarters of drivers typically use their low beams, according to Bullo. As a result, many drivers are overdriving their headlights, driving faster than they would be able to stop, based on what their headlights can reveal in front of them. But while lighting the road ahead is one battle, there's another issue that confounds nighttime drivers, the headlights from oncoming cars. Skipping the issue about other drivers objecting to your high beams or low beams, another issue is that SUVs outsell sedans by more than 2 to 1. The same headlight bulb could, in theory, be mounted 2 feet off the ground in a sports car or closer to 4 feet above the ground on a large pickup or SUV, Bullo says, which means that the light it casts could fall 2 feet higher and potentially right into your eyes. These factors are compounded by the way headlights are being made today. The newest headlights don't generate any more light than old ones, but they can seem to. A lot of these LEDs have pretty high bluish content, which we seem to be more sensitive to, Bullo says. Glare can be annoying or even blinding, a phenomenon that increases as we age. After suddenly seeing a bright light, what's called photostress recovery time takes longer when you're older, and the presence of oversized infotainment screens and tricked-out cockpit configurations in newer cars makes the interior of the car brighter, thus confusing the eyes even more. I've run out of time for this week's episode of Vision News. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode is underwritten by the Apex Lions Club, serving the community since 1937 by providing services and financial support for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. To learn more about the services provided by the Apex Lions Club, go to apexlions.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind, have low vision, or print disabilities. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Happy Thanksgiving, and so long until next week.